Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here wearing 6 inches of old age makeup in 2024. I am your host, Philip Biscobe, and with me today are two of my favorite and funniest people I know, Hunter Covington, Sean O'Connor, both here to talk about the funniest
film,
Mr. Saturday Night, if you could see their faces. This was one of those things where, and I mentioned this off mic, but I'll mention it to our listeners as well. You know, Emily's schedule can be tricky, so sometimes I do films by myself. And this was one of those movies that I was just like, I can do this one by myself, and you guys are comedians, and I'm sure this movie will be funny. I was wrong, and I'm sorry. And I mean, listen, I thought it would be. It's about stand-up comedy, guys.
I want to say there's a very specific audience that this is a fastball down the middle. The greatest thing in the world. Those people are all dead. That's fine.
It's well, yeah, I agree, but I'll also just say, like, when I pressed play on this film, and my knowledge of this movie is limited to the fact that there was a for this movie on a VHS of some movie that I watched a million times as a kid. So I've seen this trailer probably on a Castle Rock movie, might have even been I don't even know. So I knew what it was about, and I kind of knew the general vibe of it, but I had no idea it was this cloying and this kind of Oscar baity.
Yeah.
Did you guys know that going in?
I did not know that. All I remember it from, a VHS.
Yep.
And I was as a kid, I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to see this movie. Because I liked old makeup. I thought that was funny as a child. And then now, after devoting my entire life to comedy and knowing all the ins and outs, and very specifically, loving the era that it's set in.
Yeah.
Fuck Billy Crystal. He gets it all wrong. It's so bizarre. I was thinking about this. Like, this is a man who started comedy in the late 70s.
We already got to this is a man.
This is a man.
He started his comedy in the late 70s, and he has so much reverence for the 1940s style of comedy. Mm-hmm. That is so bizarre. It would be like if Dave Attell was doing, like, you know, David Brenner bits in 1993. This fucking sucks. He doesn't even understand what he's trying to do. Like, he could have watched all that, but like, this guy, he's painted in a picture as like a Lenny Bruce type. And then, like, because he's dangerous. He's calling Davy Crockett gay. It doesn't get more dangerous than that. And then every joke is the hackiest joke. It's like just a machine gun of threes. Like just nothing but threes.
It totally is. And not only that, but you get to see him tell the joke in the 50s and in present day, which is like, oh my,
this is the craziest.
The same jokes.
That's the craziest part for me. Like, is, well, we don't want to tell this in a straight line. We got to fracture the narrative on this bitch, but we're going to tee up everything so you know everything that's coming. So there's absolutely no propulsion. It just like literally hits fucking walls constantly because you're just like, I know this already. You've told me this already.
I have very a fix strange. For this entire movie. My fix. You kill Buddy Young Jr. at the beginning, and you just mostly focus on the brother relationship, and that is it. But you never see him old. You're just dealing with this fucking relationship because he's so annoying from 1938 to 1992. He's the most annoying person. I can't believe there's not one scene where his wife puts a fucking gun in her mouth.
Oh my God.
What a cursed
existence
she has.
For the people that can't see, I'm agreeing with this.
Yeah.
This is a crazy take. I think. I had a great point, and then Sean.
Well, okay, so can I want to just.
I'm sorry.
I want to just stop for a quick second here, and just say that my issue with this movie ultimately has kind of less to do with what it's about. Like conceptually, I don't really have a problem with this. It seems like we're all in agreement that like.
I'm fine with Jewish people being in comedy.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
That's I assumed as much, but I guess there's just so for me anyway, being the only Jewish person on this podcast about this movie, which is so steeped in Judaism, for lack of a better way of putting it, it wants to be a love letter to that the sort of Borscht Belt. You know, style skills. Of comedy,
yeah.
Catskills, all that kind of shit. But the problem is that the jokes don't land and they're kind of dated. So it's all kind of through this rose colored glasses of nostalgia. But this might surprise people. Billy Crystal's not a great director. So what you're left with is just very treacly, very kind of manipulative, overly sentimental stuff. That mixed in with the fact that, and you sort of tapped into this, Sean, he's a fucking asshole. Like Buddy Young Jr. is an asshole. So you're not writing for this guy.
Yeah, this was what I was going to say. And it's such a cliche at this point. And I'm positive that I've said it on the podcast. And I'm positive my wife and I have said it on the podcast. Sure. Every form I could have said it on the podcast. But like, there's not a save the cat moment. And it's so easy to say that. But like, I was just like, fuck this guy. And he has no redeeming qualities. And, you know, sadly, I think Sean's right. If you just took it from the day he became Mr. Saturday Night and you just went forward and it was about like he being like a wild card guy and his brother trying to wrangle him so they can be successful, I think that might have been interesting. But like, you're just like, you're a dick and then you got old and you're still a dick and fuck you.
I have one other pitch that is could be interesting. When Helen Hunt enters this movie, we will talk about the character, we'll talk about all the whatevers, but like if this movie was about an over the hill, an actual older man, an old comedian that was taken under the wing by some young agent that decided she wanted to rejuvenate this person's career. But, you know, he's a curmudgeon, he's an asshole, whatever, he gets in his own way. Like, that's if that was the movie, if it was just sort of a much sort of more streamlined and specific story, the problem is there's no specificity to this movie. It all just feels like just fucking bumper stickers. Like, it just doesn't feel like there's anything there.
It doesn't know what it is at all. It thinks it does, too. It is just like, It's truly just like what Billy Crystal would make a casual throwaway joke on a comic relief about. All of a sudden becomes this 2-hour movie. It does not need to be 2 hours.
God, no. Yeah.
In fact, and what's so crazy to me is the moment that like an actual comic from that like era appears, like Jerry Lewis, the small cameo of Jerry Lewis has so much more energy in it than anything else in the movie. To the point where
like a pulse, it's relevant for like 2 minutes.
That was like the death knell for me. I was like, oh God.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like Jerry Lewis, but like it just felt like for a second.
But he like called in this favor and then like him photoshopped in with like Sinatra and Dean Martin.
Oh, you're like, that was so beautiful. I love bad Photoshop. I will say I was texting with my friend Owen about this movie and he sent me outtakes from Jerry Lewis's scene and it's like 10 minutes and it's better than the entire movie.
Oh man. I mean, I believe that. But I mean, so I want to give a little bit of context for listeners before we dive into this thing whole hog. But Mr. Saturday Night is about, given his success in the early days of television, you'd think that Buddy Young Jr., played by Billy Crystal, would be coasting happily into retirement along with his wife Elaine, played by Julie Warner. Instead, Buddy is an acerbic blowhard who alienates his brother Stan, played by David Paymer, Academy Award nominee for this performance.
I thought he was good. I liked it.
I know, but the film, I mean,
no, for sure. He also beat out like a lot of people that should have been nominated, but that's neither here nor there. And everyone who fails to bow to his bullying, his agent, Annie Wells, played by Helen Hunt, has positioned elderly Buddy for a big movie role, but his irreverence might come back to bite him one last time. Mr. Saturday Night opened on September 23rd, 1992, against The Last of the Mohicans, Sneakers, Captain Ron, Singles, and School Ties. It's a real murderer's row of movies.
Boy, that's it. Would, yeah, it we should have done one of those, Sean.
Yeah, I should come up for any of those. Captain Ron, which I've never seen, but yeah. It would go on to make $23 million on a $43 million budget.
Wow.
In 1992. That's like.
That's an insane.
This is a bomb.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I actually, when I saw the $23 million, because I'm naive about movies sometimes, I was like, that seems like it made money because this seems like a movie you could make for $5
million. $43 million.
Yeah, don't know where it went.
I think like, it's that period shit. That period shit where like they just blew it out. Mm-hmm. Like they spent way too much money on that stuff, I guess.
But even then, I'm trying to remember if there was like cars. Like there's not even like old cars. There's like
there's some exterior
hotel rooms, and then like you know like the interior of like a Catskills refreshment hall or something.
Yeah, I think it's like the show, like the behind the scenes and all that, because it's like hundreds of extras. Like,
yeah,
there's extras everywhere, and then there's everyone's in costume, and I'm sure he was like, it's gotta be blah blah blah.
I wonder if there were reshoots as well. Like, I wonder if like there was some element. I mean, I don't know because you know this movie is lost to time for good reason. But I do think that. That's a very steep price tag.
But I mean, also it's like Billy Crystal at the height of Billy Crystal.
Correct.
It's Babalu,
and
Lowell Gans. Like, I mean, like that's a hefty fee. I don't think there was any reshoots because that would imply that Billy Crystal knows when something's bad.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you have like a, this is sort of like, people are like, why did auteur cinema die? It's like, well, I mean, this wasn't the entire thing, but it's like he was obviously given $43 million and said, tell your story, buddy.
My guess, you are right, though, Sean, that like Billy Crystal and Babalu and Lowell, you've got to assume that's probably $10 million right there, right?
Yeah.
Or close to it.
Yeah, because this is also the height of their powers. Honestly, it's like kind of a 1992 dream team.
It is.
Although there is a famous 1992 dream team that dominated the U.S. Olympics,
They were named after this dream team.
Yeah.
I think you'll.
But also, A League of Their Own comes out in '92, which also Babalu and Lowell wrote. Right. I mean, these guys are, you said, they're sort of at the peak of their powers.
Is this pre? This is post City Slickers, I would guess.
This is so. Yeah, I was going to talk about Billy's filmography for a second here. Obviously. Yeah. It feels like Running Scared is when people first notice him. Then it's Princess Bride, Throw Mama from the Train, When Harry Met Sally, City Slickers. So it's like he's just, he's never going to be bigger than he is in this moment. So he cashes in all his chips to do this movie. And then right after it, it's a bomb. 2 years later, he's doing City Slickers too. It's like he's just... Yeah. And then he directs and writes Forget Paris, which I always forget he wrote and directed, which that movie is pretty forgettable in its own right. But yeah, and then it's just like Father's Day, that terrible Robin Williams movie, the French remake, you know. And then he's kind of in No Man's Land until Analyze This, which is kind of a hit that no one sees coming.
That was a hit. Deconstructing Harry was also, I mean, to me, I really like it.
Yeah.
And I think Billy Crystal is far worse than Woody Allen.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. I mean, listen, he's laughing.
I'm joking.
Chris has got that Monsters, Inc. money, so he's laughing too. But I mean,
which he's great in, by the way. Great voice actor. Great voice for that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. I think, though, to answer your sort of what you were circling there, Hunter, like this is
the peak moment, Crystal. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And I mean, I don't begrudge him. The funny thing is, I want to say like 15, 20 minutes into this movie, I was like, I 100% understand what he thought he was making. Right. Like, I get why he thought that this was his chance to get into another gear, to change the way people perceived him, to direct something like all that. Like, I get it.
And sort of like half stepping with like, it's still comedy. Like, it's not a comedy. You know what I'm saying, though?
I do.
No, I'm saying I get the theory of like,
yes, yes.
It's sort of like Jim Carrey, Man on the Moon, where it's
yes,
like,
yes,
it's a funny fit. It's in a funny arena, but it's not funny.
Yeah.
It's the idea that only a comedian can play this guy because there is the only person who can capture that kind of rhythm.
Or the worst jokes that only 6-year-olds will like.
Jesus Christ.
Here's a question I have, guys. And I mean, because you're both your comedy writers, Sean, you did stand up. Hunter, did you ever do stand up? I don't know if you have or not. Okay.
Just around my kids.
Okay. And you kill. With I kill. Them, right?
not really. You'd be surprised. Yeah.
They're the toughest audience.
This movie is brimming with people pretending to laugh, and it is so brutal to watch.
It's awful. I noticed, like, Julie Warner specifically, who I really love, Julie Warner, and I felt bad for her in this role.
Yep.
Yes.
I noticed her fake laugh was the worst of the group. She just seemed tired. Like, she would do like she would exhale and then shake her head. Like, that was it.
It made me think of the line in Fight Club when they're on the plane and Edward Norton laughs and Brad Pitt says, you know, there's a sick desperation in your laugh. I feel like everyone is just trying to convince us, the audience, that he's funny. And that's exhausting to watch.
Bill, to answer your question, if I ever did stand up and the audience laughed as hard as those people, I would literally say, fuck you guys, and I would leave. I would be like...
You think you're being pranked?
I would be like, "There's, I'm not that funny." I'd be like, Crystal's not that funny. I mean, it's crazy. They're like scream laughing at him.
They are scream laughing, but I also noticed, and this is the true sign of a fake laugh, there's not rolling laughs.
Yeah.
It is start and stop, start and stop. Is exactly what those jokes deserve. They do not deserve, like, I can't catch my breath type laughter. They are zeros. I gave them threes earlier. I'm downgrading it.
Yeah, it's like, it's a weird... I mean, normally you hear something funny and you start laughing. Like, I can't believe I'm fucking talking about this. Normally you hear something funny, you start laughing. And then... as you're laughing, your brain's kind of unpacking it and you're kind of thinking about it and it kind of keeps you laughing. But these jokes are so fucking shallow that it is like a ha! Like, that's all you can give it.
I love like the current day scenes where he's like sitting down with the director and he's doing his shtick, which is just like, it's exhausting. And even the director, who is his super fan, is just kind of giving him nothing.
He's just like, is it over smile. Yet? Yeah. I mean,
So we mentioned Bubbaloo Mandel and Lil Gans, and these are two guys. They starred in they did Night Shift in 82, the Ron Howard movie, Splash, Spies Like Us, Gung Ho, Parenthood, City Slickers, League of Their Own. Like, they're on a fucking tear in the 80s and 90s, early 90s. And then I would argue this movie destroys them because everything after that is just, you know, Greedy. Do you remember that movie? Do you guys ever see that movie?
Was that Jack Black?
Michael J. Fox?
No, that's Envy. Yes, Michael J. Fox. Jack Black is Envy. You're thinking of Envy. The Other Sin. Then they wrote City Slickers 2, Forget Paris, Multiplicity, Father's Day, Where the Heart Is, Robots, Fever Pitch, Tooth Fairy. Like, it's just, this movie kind of ruins them. Like, I don't.
Well, it's obviously a labor of love because it was so laborious.
They're also in it as the writers that he fires.
Oh, yeah. Are they?
I watched the credits. I think he goes, you're fired. And he says, the third guy goes, I don't work here. And he goes, you're hired. You're fired.
Yeah.
This is the level of jokes, guys. Just FYI. If you don't want to watch Mr. Saturday Night, which, by the way, you can't rent. So we had to quite frankly illegally download it because I refused to pay for it. It is strange to me because these guys can be funny. Despite what you guys might think of Billy Crystal, and we'll do a deep dive into Billy Crystal, I do kind of feel as though this should work. Like, on paper, this is the type of project that it's 1992, why wouldn't you think this would work? Right? If you were a studio executive, you would give the green light to this project.
I mean, if I was myself, I probably wouldn't, because I'm not charmed by Billy Crystal at all. Like, I think a lot of people love When Harry Met Sally. And I think the reason why they do is because Bruno Kirby and Carrie Fisher carry that movie. And they like old people telling their stories. Harry and Sally, unlikable pieces of shit. Go fuck yourselves. I hate you.
All right. Well, I'm not going to ride with you on that. When Harry Met Sally is in my top five favorite films of all time. But I...
Oh, wow. So you like Billy Crystal in some way.
Well, this is the thing. And Hunter, I obviously want to hear your thoughts on this too. Yeah. I think that Billy Crystal can be charming. I don't think he's always charming. I don't for instance, I never really got the Oscars thing. I never really got the why that worked for people. Like, he always just felt kind of just like a shitty version of, I don't know, Bob Hope or whoever the fuck they had doing, you know, the Oscars back in the day. But when he did have that moment in the 80s and early 90s, I did sort of feel as though he was in the pocket and there was something going on there. He had some juice. If I look at When Harry Met Sally objectively, I don't think that he's an attractive person. I don't really understand. They don't make sense, and yet they make sense. So I don't know what to tell you on that front, but I hear you. I hear you. What are your thoughts on Billy Crystal, Hunter?
Oh, man. It's hard. I mean, I was literally just talking to somebody about liking City Slickers. And so I think, you know, that movie I connected with, just a good idea for a movie, good movie. I don't know. I've always found him insufferable, but kind of assumed he's just like not for me, you know?
Yeah.
Like he's like a New York guy. Is he a New York guy?
He is, yeah.
I'm not a New York person. Like, I fucking do not enjoy it. So he's automatically just like not for me. But here's what I want to say. And here's a thing that comes up in this movie, which is he's so obsessed with baseball. It's like he's like a 7-year-old that can't do anything without comparing it to baseball. Or like all the shit about when he meets his wife to be and she says something funny, he's like, that's an off the wall double, blah. And it's like, oh my God, dude. Any woman would be like, shut the fuck up. I don't want to be around you anymore. Like, don't compare my jokes to fucking baseball. Like, so that shit's just sort of the insufferable side of him. Although I did say last night before I watched this, I was going to come in very pro Crystal. But I think Phil's the pro Crystal guy here.
I mean, I'm certainly the most pro Crystal on this episode, but here's the question I have for you guys: of the
comedy, not in life, there, like, Billy Crystal really loves Billy Crystal. We could all agree about that.
There's no bigger fan
Billy of Billy Crystal, Crystal and then baseball. It's he's at war with himself. What do I love more?
To me, I think you made a perfect, he is very New York, and he's so sweaty. Yeah, I always feel like he's just like he needs a laugh in every moment. And that desperation absolutely does not work on film. Like the guy who is just trying to get anything from someone.
It feels like the directing is sweaty also. Like, it's like he's trying to get a laugh within the movie and outside of the movie at the same time. The double sweat.
My question is about the stand-up component of this, because I actually think that Billy Crystal, when he's not literally begging for your laughs, which is, I would argue, what a stand-up is doing, and instead he is adhering to a script and has to sort of hit jokes or improvise or what have you. You know, his improvisation in This Is Spinal Tap is really funny. I think that he can be quite good under the right circumstances. The problem is I've never seen him do stand-up. So I've never watched the comedy relief. You know, it was him and Whoopi and Robin Williams, that sort of trifecta in the 80s that were, making money for charities and what have you through stand-up. So I never saw any of his stand-up. I've seen some of Robin's stand-up, which is kind of insufferable in its own way, just very manic and too much. And I don't know what Whoopi's stand-up looked like, but I'm curious as to sort of what you got. Do you think that the stand-up component is what's making this feel so desperate?
Well, no, I think that is just what his stand-up was. I mean, like, famously, he has the character, the jazz man, he's done blackface quite a bit, and which to me is just like, you know, I don't know what's funny, but you have to appreciate how hard I'm trying.
I forgot about his Sammy Davis Jr. stuff that he would do.
Yes, he has Sammy Davis Jr., but he has Jazzman. He also has Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
His stand-up is very similar to that, where it was kind of, it's like proto Dana Carvey, where it's like all kind of character-based.
Okay.
And like kind of assaulting the audience with energy.
Which I think, you know, this is, he's playing a character, caricature.
Yes.
So I think it's very apt, you know?
I think this is a character he's done before. I feel like he did this on SNL.
I was going to talk about the development of this. It's a weird thing. I know
everything about Billy Crystal. I'm sorry.
Hey, man. Familiarity breeds contempt. I mean, it's just...
Crystal originated this character in a 1984 HBO special. And then in an 85 episode of Saturday Night Live, he made an appearance as the character on a Weekend Update segment. And then, I guess, built it from there into this...
Here's how you know it's not ready for a movie. He didn't do it twice.
There's one thing I think is interesting, though. One night the producer said, Johnny Cash, June Cash, and Waylon Jennings are in the audience tonight. What if I put them near the Weekend Update desk? I did Buddy Live as kind of a Don Rickles character and did funny interplay with them. I had no idea what I was going to say. I mean, okay. I think all of this is to say that, like, obviously the style of Billy Crystal no longer exists, right? And I think it had a very short shelf life, as you can see from his filmography. For the most part, it seemed like people kind of liked him in rom-com-y situations, sort of, and then it kind of just disappeared on him. And I also feel like what feeds that is as you mentioned earlier, Sean, this reverence for a style of comedy that's like 50 years previous.
What's interesting that you say that, because I actually saw Don Rickles. And the thing about Don Rickles is he's, first of all, he's so funny. So there's one strike against Billy Crystal.
Yeah. A true god. I'm so excited when he would show up and things.
I mean, but Don Rickles is very self-deprecating.
Yes.
And they're like the sweetest guy ever. And so when he makes fun of people, it's so funny.
Yeah. But he's threading a needle. Like he's doing a high wire act.
But Billy was like, Don Rickles is hilarious because he roasts people. I'm going to roast people. And you're like, no, you missed the. There was a thing he was doing that you've missed.
He's never, like, in anything, the butt of the joke.
Right.
Never.
I remember, like, I think about this a lot. I read an interview with him probably in, like, 2007, where he was talking about, like, his whole career, and he was talking about how, to him, his career is a failure because his main goal was to host The Tonight Show, and he didn't get to do it. And I remember, like, reading that and being like, I'm so happy you realize you're a failure. Like, that will help me sleep tonight.
I do think interesting that you're the Don Rickles component, right? And this, like, buddy not, like, missing the joke and miss, like, there's this continual callback of, did you see what I did there in this movie? Oof. And I'm just like, guys, if you have to ask if they got your joke, you're
the fucking the mouth things joke. They do to each other.
I can't.
It's all like,
or
whoa.
The daughter, the weird face that the daughter, like
the double take thing.
That is so unearned. That is like the most unearned scene I've ever seen in a film.
He 100%.
He tries to buy his daughter's love with a check.
Yes. That's it.
He does.
He does. He gives her $13,000, goes, your grandma loved you, and then it just is supposed to heal all wounds. Fuck you.
I mean, but you saying that he's never the butt of the joke, I mean, this is a guy, had he really existed, this person, who everyone at some point would have just eviscerated to his face and said, fuck you. And nobody does in the movie. Everyone's like, yeah. Why not?
He's so easy to. So sensitive.
Well, that's the thing too. There's this weird kind of like, it's all obviously very sort of performative, right? Like it's all a defense mechanism because obviously he has this insecurity because he basically stole his brother's bit and built a career off of it, and then like kind of didn't feel bad about it. But what I do find interesting, so this movie comes out September of 92. It's got 59% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 38 from audiences. So like critics weren't really on its side, but Ebert gives it 3 out of 4 stars and says, at some point during the past decade, stand-up comedy became a spectator sport, a struggle of will between comedian and audience. Comedians began to see themselves as heroic figures, as indeed they probably were, especially in those comedy clubs where the audiences sit there getting progressively sloshed while the management throws comedians at them like tag team relays. The rewards are great, a slot on The Tonight Show, a cable special, maybe someday Jay Leno's job, but failure can be brutal. He talks about sort of the poignancy of this movie, and he talks about the idea of like, and again, I don't think that he's wrong to see that in this movie, the sense of someone who is their own worst enemy. Like, again, this idea, yeah. And Sean Hunter, I'm sure you guys know many people. I mean, this town is littered with a whole bunch of comedians that didn't make it or self-loathing, what have you. There's something there. He's just completely unable to execute it in this movie.
Well, that's why it feels like this review to me just feels like projected.
Yeah.
It's like just something that Ebert is projecting onto it, which doesn't really fit.
It's the promise of the movie, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, yeah.
There's poor execution. And, like, I love Ebert, but, I mean, this is a man who also gave 3 stars to Behind the Green Door. So, I mean, yeah. obviously.
Sometimes if this is a guy who wrote
The Valley of the Dolls, so it's like.
Ebert sees some tits, you're probably going to get a pretty good rating. But I also feel like he does complain at the end of the review about the happy ending, and he's just like, buddy doesn't deserve a happy ending, right?
No,
like fundamentally. No. So I do kind of agree that if this movie actually had the balls, it doesn't, but if it did, to be like, this guy doesn't get a happy ending,
I'd
respect the movie more.
I agree. I feel like his downfall in the 50s or 60s, whenever like he's getting fired and he's getting those notes, I wish they would have like actually leaned into the Lenny Bruce of it all. Like, I think that would have actually made why he was like so hard to be around. Like, at least like when you watch Lenny, which I think is a much better movie than this, like you have to care about the guy a little bit. So you keep going like, oh, don't do that. Instead of he's just fucking annoying. And you're like, please don't do this. Can you just stop tripping over your own dick? Like, you kind of, I feel like that's why Lenny Bruce is a sympathetic figure, is like the man had no ability to control himself. And like, you see the reasons why he couldn't control himself. And he was also rallying against like censorship. And this guy's rallying against nothing other than like, he just wants to be the most famous person.
Yeah.
And he's not.
Well, I think there was that, there's like a weird moment where they show a picture of him from his 60s psychedelic phase.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, well, that's sort of interesting. Like, why is that just a throwaway? Like, because like you're saying, it's he's only ever upset that, like, a lot of what stand-up comedy is about society and fucking social mores and folkways, whatever the fuck, right? Sure. And so this is a guy that's only writing for himself. And he's only upset, like when he says that Davy Crockett's gay or whatever. That's only in service of himself. It's not, there's not like a, it's not connected to a bigger thing. It's not, you know what I mean? It's just like, okay. Like,
yeah.
It's,
yeah.
They also didn't do something that I also think would improve this is they never showed him with his peers in the past. So, like, when he's at the Friars Club talking about, like, that big agent who had the exact same rhythm as him, I felt like they just kept writing Buddy Young for every character. But, like, when he's at the Friars Club waiting for them, he's with older comics, and he doesn't give them anything to do. There's no even, like nod to what they have accomplished. Like, it is all about Billy Crystal. It's having these famous old comics who we don't know who they are, but he does. And they don't talk. They just laugh at him.
They're just kowtowing to him.
It's,
yeah, you know, what's funny though?
Yes.
It makes me think, Sean, that, that Lowell and Babalo are like, okay, here's the new draft. And Billy is like, I won't take a pass. And then it's like, it's just his, every character just sounds like him. What is this? Yes. He gets writing credit for this? What is this?
Jerry Orbach, like, when you introduce, like, he has the same, like, he's just doing those jokes and, like, he just keeps doing the dictionary thing. Oh, my.
And fucking Jerry Orbach's just there going, I mean, it's, what you wonder about, like, how much of a vanity project this is. Like, it's really just him jerking off and how sort of painful that is to watch. There's also, and I think, Hunter, you perhaps were alluding to, the credits of this movie are Billy Crystal and then an ampersand between Lowell and Babalu. So these three did not work together. It's clear that Lowell and Babalu went off and did their thing, gave him a script, and then at a certain point we're just like, we're wiping our hands of this, like, do whatever the fuck you want to do with it. But I do feel like, you know, we're honing in just for the audience to understand the reason that this Davy Crockett gay thing, because it's we don't ever actually see the downfall. We just, it is alluded to that that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and that that was when, you know, America turned on Buddy Young Jr. It's a weird thing to not actually see the downfall. And I think it speaks to what you're saying, Sean. He can't ever be wrong. Like, it's weird that this movie is just there to service. It's like, yeah, he's a curmudgeon, but he's not wrong. It's like, but he is wrong. He's a fucking asshole.
Well, I think it's like when you're, you know, one of these edgy, you know, I'm just sounding like a fucking idiot, but like when you're an edgy comedian railing against the system, it's like, that's fucking cool. Like when you're just, like, you're just railing against people that want you to work in like a structured environment. And you're like, well, I don't understand. Like, you have a job. And people are paying you. Just do the fucking thing they're paying you to do. Not, don't be a dick about it.
One of the other thought, and you're 100% right. It's just, to me, this movie felt exactly like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, where she just keeps fucking up and like ruining her shots. And I think that I didn't really like that show, but now after watching Mr. Saturday Night, I think it's infinitely better than Mr. Saturday Night.
Right. I mean, I will also say too that it's different in the form of a television show than in the form of a movie, right? Like,
yeah,
as we all know, television, you need conflict, you need failure, you need various sort of things to build the character. This, it's a series of like shtick mixed in with like just a fucking asshole that doesn't really learn from any of his mistakes. And on some level, we'll talk about the audition scene when we get to it, but like on some level, the way that goes felt like comeuppance. You're like, yeah,
it was, and it was minor comeuppance. Like, that like truly pissed me off. It would have been so much more rewarding for him to actually flop, but he did a good job and they still told him no. Like that's how
but they pre-told him no.
Yeah.
Like they told him no, then they were like, you can go ahead and do it. But then also no. It's like,
it was pretty amazing. We'll get to that scene, but I do want to ask a question as comedy writers. When you are writing a movie or a television show where it's about comedy, I feel like the bar is so much fucking higher for those jokes, because within the universe, you have to believe that this person's a fucking great comedian, right? Like, I liked Maisel Fine. I never finished it, and I plan to one of these days. I liked the first three seasons of it anyway. And I did feel as though the jokes were good enough, right? Like, enough that I bought her success. In this, I was just like, none of these jokes are funny. So I don't buy this guy being a success.
Yeah, I mean, truly, I think like I mostly, when people that do stand-up comedy in television shows, I fucking hate it so much. I think it's the worst thing and you should never show it. If you're going to tell me a person's great, go for it. Tell me they're great. I'll believe it. Just don't show it. I feel like the only time I've really loved it is Obvious Child. I thought Jenny Slate's stand-up was really good in it for what her character is supposed to be, which is like kind of an open micer in Brooklyn. I mean, like any other time, like it sucks. It just sucks. Can I ask, so much.
The movie I thought about a fair amount when I was watching this one was Funny People. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you guys land on Funny People, and obviously I want to know, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's funny stuff in that. Funny stuff created in the universe, I should clarify, of the film.
Yeah. I think Funny People Part 1 is good. The sequel sucks.
That's what I was going to say.
Which is totally fair. I the reason I brought it up, just because I feel like I remember when that film came out. I remember the way it was received, which was not particularly fondly. It felt like it, you know, it had a lot of baggage. It felt like everyone was sort of hoping this was, I guess, going to be like Adam Sandler makes good and finally like breaks through into sort of, you know, Oscar-y kind of what have you. And same with that. Like all of it just felt like it had a lot of expectations on it. But the stuff worked relatively well in terms of what it was trying to do. Like I believed that universe, and I feel like that's really hard to do for what it's worth, as we're all sort of saying, like, show me how they make this.
Well, what I loved about, you know, like Jonah and Seth's stand up in that movie is they were literally going around LA doing every show, honing the act. So they were actually doing it the right way. And I feel like, what's her face? Mrs. Maisel. I can't remember her name. Lois Lane. Rachel Brosnahan. She's not going around New York, going up at the Cellar.
She's not doing such.
Yeah.
I think that I also don't think that Billy did either.
Absolutely not.
This is in his blood, Phil. This isn't I'll say my quote from, I can't remember what athlete it is, but they ask him about stretching and he says, does a cheetah stretch? And I was like, that's fucking fair. I'll say two things from a writing perspective about stand-up and trying to do funny things within the universe of the thing that you've created. One of them is I'm going to compare it to a classic sitcom trap, which is let's have a character come up with a great invention. Okay, let's come up with a great invention. If you can come up with a great invention, don't be a fucking writer. Yeah. You don't fucking do it. So if you can write great stand-up, just go fucking do it, because it's not useful here. It's like,
yeah,
not,
yeah.
So that's one thing. And the second thing is, if my wife was, if my wife Stacey was on, I'll only mention her because she's on sure. this frequently. Yeah, yeah. She has a hard and fast rule of nobody can laugh in a comedy, which eliminates a lot of this shit. And you know, yeah. and that's like a big network note. It's like, have her laugh at him so we know they're having a thing. But it's like, I don't sit around bantering with my wife and we're both like guffawing about what each other is saying in real life. So it's just weird when somebody in the universe, like, what if all the friends just thought Joey was hilarious? It would be like insane. It would be like, they're all just laughing at his jokes. Like, what are you doing?
No, that's absolutely true. And it does add this sort of, I agree 100% with Stacey that like it takes you out of it. But then I also feel like in this film, it feels like they're giving you sort of the ability to laugh because they're afraid that the jokes might not be landing. So they need someone to sort of point the audience and be like, see, he's funny.
Well, it's a multicam trick. Is like if they believe if they're showing the audience laughing that you at home or you in the theater will be laughing at this.
Yeah.
Right. Because we're telling you where the jokes are and when it ends.
Which is like is sort of true in terms of if you can go to a theater and watch a comedy and if other people aren't laughing, your experience will be terrible.
Yes.
No matter what. But if everyone's laughing, even if the movie's not really that funny, you feel like, hey, I did a thing and it was fun.
When you like I saw Madame Web in theaters and everyone in the audience was like losing it. And right. It was one of the best movie-going experiences of my entire life. And, like, yeah, I laughed, like, 1,000 times more at that than Mr. Saturday Night.
Yeah. When I saw opening night, Snakes on a Plane, it was the best thing ever. Somebody in the back of the theater was throwing, like, plastic, like, little rubbery snakes, like, just throwing handfuls out over the theater and they were landing on people. Yeah. It was fucking amazing.
But I also think this is one of those things, and not to go down a rabbit hole on this, but it's one of the things that I think is so disappointing about the matriculation of comedies to streaming, which is that comedy movies, when you're in a packed theater on a big hit movie and everyone's fucking laughing their faces off, like there's nothing better than that. And it feeds it and it makes the experience and it makes the movie just better. It's not to say that comedies don't work on Netflix. I mean, I'm sure they do, but they just don't have the same energy. It's just
the same energy. Like, I mean, when you get swept away, you come home and you give Bottoms a 4.5-star review on Letterboxd. And then it's like your friends who watched on streaming are like, are you nuts?
Yeah, I don't
but
get
then
it.
You're like, yeah, like, no, you have to see it in a theater. It was great.
I mean, literally the experience I had. Saw it at the theater. Yeah. It played like gangbusters. Gave it a great review, and then everyone watched and was like, "Okay, it's fine." I mean,
I really like it, but I loved it in theaters.
Yeah,
but you know, it's like
I saw it in the theater, and it killed.
Oh yeah, because you can also be like in a movie, yes, where you're like, "This shouldn't be working. I'm dying." Like, but I saw Tropic Thunder. And when those fake trailers play in a real movie theater that no one knows what's happening, it was like they could have stopped it after the fake trailers and people would have been like, greatest movie ever. Don't even care that they didn't show a movie. Greatest experience.
But I do think that this isn't that. But it's also just like there seems to be this movie seems to be giving permission to its audience constantly to enjoy this movie, which is fucking awful.
It's demanding you enjoy it. Like if you really like, I would love to see the screenplay because I believe Billy Crystal's character has 91% of the lines and every single thing he says is an attempt at a joke. And I would say he's successful twice throughout the entire movie. Like,
yeah,
and that's part of like he's an asshole and he doesn't shut up. And I think it's a little bit different if you don't work in Hollywood, but everybody knows a guy like this who just can't stop making jokes. And you're like, I can't hang out with that guy tonight. He's fucking exhausting.
Yeah, like, he's always just, on.
Yeah, and it's really, that as a character trait is horrific.
And as a viewer, as an audience member,
yeah,
forced to hang out with this guy. I mean, I will say, as I was watching this, I was thinking about Miracle Max and The Princess Bride, the older character, the sort of Miracle Max. He brings him back to life. He's like, I don't know, whatever. He's in like two scenes, and he's also caked under a ton of old age makeup, and he's this old character, and it's him and Carol Kane, and it's a great like two scene performance. And I think the reason that it works is because it's so heightened, like because it's existing in this, you know, fantasy world.
The fairy tale. Here, yeah.
I just don't want to see this guy try to like give me fucking shtick for 2 hours. And then apparently I'm supposed to care about him at the end when he's been a fucking asshole to everybody. I just don't get it.
I mean, the more and more I'm thinking about it, Hunter, you're completely right. The no save the cat moment, and like in the spot where that would happen, he's just like a shithead to his daughter. It's like, honestly, yeah, he's irredeemable. He's just a piece of shit like the whole time. Yeah.
And also, like, his daughter is a recovering addict who's been divorced twice, and he's like using that as like punchlines. He's like making fun of his daughter.
Again, another interesting plot point that they completely just like shoo away after two like just dismissive jokes about it. And then like, if you're gonna hang the entire film's emotion on them, like their relationship, give us something more than that. Like, not just two throwaway.
It bookends the movie. He comes in, he's like,
you have to think she's like this because of you, buddy. Like,
yeah.
He walks into his house. He sees his daughter is there. He basically says, like, you getting fucking high with your shitty boyfriend or something. Like, just rubs her face in something terrible. And then she's like, I'm fucking leaving. And he's like, good. And then they talk about her off screen a couple times, him and the wife. And then at the end, he gives her a check and makes her do a bit. And, we're
just- and she cries. And she fucking
a single cried. Tear, a single tear runs down her cheek to let you know that this movie is
crazy shit. It's crazy shit that you
and
can
the
make
fact
this-
that David Paymer never like just kicked him in the nuts and walked away. David Paymer coming back, you're like, bro, don't come back.
Yeah, David Paymer.
I'm so sad. I mean,
listen,
battered wife syndrome for David Paymer.
Let's all pour one out for David Paymer, who, as I mentioned, got an Oscar nomination for this performance. I want to talk about his.
I think he's the best part of the movie by far.
I mean, 100%
bar,
but
it is the lowest bar. But my God, when he's on screen, like you feel for him when he like wants to dance with Julie Warner, or he's dancing.
Oh my
with
God!
Her,
yeah, but he's also sketching her from offstage.
Yeah. Yes.
That shit.
Once you know he's gonna paint in 50 years when he retires,
I guess.
I mean, when he is into her, and then has to deliver her to his brother, like it's so irredeemable. I don't have a brother, but I've seen brothers before. I've seen them interact. I have two uncles that hate each other. Like, I get it. It's complicated. That was so fucking messy. And he was just sort of like, you want to fuck her like later in life? And you're like, oh my God.
Well, it's another thing though. It's like a dangling, like loose plot point that like, there's just so many interesting things they set up and then they just bring back to just mention at the end because they need to focus more on Billy Crystal doing bits. He just keeps ignoring the movie that could be a movie to do bits.
Well, it's like also, Why can't David Paymer just punch him in the fucking face? Like, I mean, it's like,
he's the older brother. He's like,
that's what's crazy to me is it always plays like Billy Crystal's the older brother.
Yes.
And like the way he treats him later in life is so older brother, little brother, but it's very strange.
Part of the problem is that that Stan, that's the character that David Paymer plays, that Stan is painted as this sort of weaker, right? Because he's not an asshole. so there's this like, and it seems to almost be like a cancer that eats this guy alive over the course of his career, of his life, where he's got this brother who's just nagging him constantly, and you're not doing enough for me. He's also his manager, which is toxic and fucked in its own right too, where you're just like, there's that first scene when we're in quote-unquote present day and they're in like a Chinese food restaurant, and like Buddy's just like, why am I not making any money, why do you fucking suck at your job, I fucking hate it. Just like, yeah. I what are you doing, man? Like,
I mean, when he quits, it's like, holy shit,
yeah,
you fucking did it,
you did it, man. Yeah.
He's never going to have to talk to this dude again. I guarantee it.
It's pretty crazy. So David Paymer, who is, you know, a character actor that's been in 8 million things. I'm not going to work through his entire career here. But yeah. I'll say that the things that I remember him in that he's popped for me, he's great in Quiz Show as like the fucking basically the villain network executive. He's great in that. I love him in Get Shorty. He's great in the, I think it's Ocean's 13. Where he's, they just treat him abhorrently, and he's great. He's just, yeah, he's in truly a million. You've seen him in a million things. Do you guys have a Paymer take?
I mean, I just really like him, and he plays essentially the same character in Marvelous Miss Maisel.
Also true.
I mean, yeah. He's pretty specific. I mean, he's always like he's always pretty much himself.
Yeah,
but he's great. I love him.
Yeah, he plays like the Toby Ziegler character in An American President, like the character that ultimately has turned into the Richard Schiff role in The West Wing.
Right, right.
So like, you know, he's there is. Listen, I don't have anything bad to say about David Paymer other than the fact that I just wish, you know, he was in a better movie. You know, he's he seems like a lovely man.
Yes, I mean, he does fantastic work in everything, and yeah. This is no exception. I do want to give a special shout out. The one thing about this movie that I truly, I was like, oh, I felt this on like a fundamental level. And I was like, I'm like, this is the only accurate thing in the whole movie is when he's watching television with David Paymer and Julie Warner. And he's just sitting there stone faced as they're laughing. I'm like, I felt like that was a mirror. I genuinely cannot laugh at anything that makes my friends and family laugh, and I am miserable watching
dead inside. Is that? I mean, is it? I mean,
who knows? I mean,
really, that, who can say?
I'll say this
though: this movie also ping pongs around a bunch of different sort of narrative devices, which I also think is kind of weird. The movie opens with him being interviewed by Richard Kind, who gets literally like 6 lines and then is just escorted off of set, and we never see this character again. And I was like, okay, when it started, I was like, I'm assuming we're going to have like, there's fucking doing a documentary or he's doing a piece on this guy, and we're going to have like Richard Kind punctuating this movie with stories.
Right. It's like going to be the framing device.
Yeah. That would make sense. Nope. We just drop that for no good reason.
We like catch up whenever it's towards the beginning.
Yep.
We like catch up. They're sitting there. Richard Kind leaves. You're like, great idea, Richard. Do not come back.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out, man. Fucking get in your car and drive, buddy.
But what's weird about it is that then what happens is the first, I want to say like 20 minutes or so of this movie is brimming with expositional dialogue where they're constantly telling us stuff, like the two brothers are being like, remember that time when, and remember when we did this then, and we're filling everybody in, we're backfilling everything when you could have had this fucking interview or two. Like, what are you doing?
Like, you have the device to develop it, yeah. Or to deliver it like in a very nice organic way, yeah. And instead he's walking from backstage going, well, you wouldn't be my brother if you didn't blah, blah, blah. You're like, oh, Jesus.
It's crazy.
Like,
it's,
that's
it
a really rough
is
one.
Like, I found it so baffling more than anything. Because I'm like, these people know how storytelling works.
Works. Yes. I mean, like, literally, again, like a dream team for 1992.
I know.
The most baffling thing in the world to me was that it had a special credit of the opening title sequence was designed by Saul Bass, who, I mean, a complete legend. Greatest. And it is just literally, there's nothing. It is just,
it's
there's no special credits. Font. It's,
well, I, okay, yeah. The opening
credits. What did Saul Bass do?
So, I'm gonna defend this just slightly here.
Yeah.
The opening credits of this movie are what seem like an old Jewish family and the various delicacies that they're making and what have you, yeah. Right? And you know, as someone who grew up in this universe, I found it somewhat endearing. To your point, the Saul Bass of it all, my assumption is that it was gonna be more stylized. Like that there was going to be more like
they storyboarded it or something.
Yeah. Right. Like when I think of Saul Bass's credit sequences, I think of Casino or you know, fucking North by Northwest or you know, I mean like it, so
iconic. Yes, I mean like Hitchcock and Otto Preminger, and like he's super good at that.
Yeah.
But also I liked the opening credits. I thought I was like gonna enjoy this movie based on it.
Yeah,
and it's also the only well-directed part of the entire film.
Probably because Saul Bass directed it.
I mean, potentially, because when you get to the funeral towards the end, it is lit exactly like a TV movie. It looks like Late Shift. It looks really bad.
Well, just like blow it all out and we can move the cameras faster.
No, 100%. So the DP on this film is, oh my God, what is his name? Don Peterman, who actually did like Men in Black. And did a bunch of like Barry Sonnenfeld movies. And you can see some of that, and I don't want to say cartoonish, but like, let's just say overly stylized with the flashbacks to them and their family, right? That's when like, you can tell that somebody took the time to actually light and do production design and costumes and all that kind of stuff. So it really does stick out. The rest of the movie is flat as shit and like has very little, there's very little dynamics to it.
I mean, I think
all the flashbacks, actually, I would say the stuff in the behind the scenes of the TV show looks pretty good. It's just all the present day stuff.
Yeah, I think I thought that the opening credit stuff was going to like tie into the flashbacks of his family.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And it was sort of like, oh, we just have the same shit shot two different ways.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I get it.
I was like, that's sort of weird.
It only ties in the way where they just kept making jokes about their mom's arms throughout the entire movie. Like,
she has like this so like fluffy skin under her arms.
Yeah. So as when their kids doing their two man act, just riffing on their family, they're just mostly making fun of the mom's arms. Then on his wedding day, he takes two pieces of bread, puts it on his mom's arm and pretends to take a bite.
And she fucking loves it.
She's screaming, scream laughing.
Guys. Screaming. Which, by the way, on Billy Crystal's The Comedians on FX with Josh Gad, two crystals do not make a right. They do a whole sketch about a goiter that is the same thing he does in his
sketch.
Yeah, it's the same exact beat.
I tried to watch that show. It was tough. It was a tough hang.
Yeah. I
I tried to work on that show.
I think I tried to work on that show too. Hey kids, if you really want to live your dreams of Hollywood, you can go and you can submit yourself for shows that you would fucking never dream of working on, but you will be begging to work on them.
You're begging, like begging to work with somebody that you find has anti-charisma. Like that you openly hate. Them. Yeah.
I think that the buddy getting the
That's post, good.
The buddy getting the post Beatles bit is pretty funny.
That was, I enjoyed that. And he,
I mean,
that's great. That was great. That I really laughed and I said, that's a good bit.
Him trying to push through, like, it's very funny.
I thought that was funny. I think that, and I mentioned this earlier, but like the family flashback stuff is just, it's kind of cringy, just because it feels a little too treacly and it's trying too hard.
But to jump back, when the Beatles things happened, mm-hmm. I'm laying on a bed watching it on my laptop, and I think I said, that's funny, which means something's not that funny.
Conceptually, like that's a pretty good idea. And that is what I want more. I would have wanted more of is bits like that. Like
I'm saying, you need like a comedian needs like a take, like what, like something interesting.
Can I just say very quickly, what you just said reminded me of something that one of my favorite movie going experiences over the last few years was I went to see the live action Lion King movie, which isn't very good, whatever. And I'm sitting there.
William Friedkin begs to differ. He said it was the future of film before he died.
That's cool. So in behind me is a 6 or 7 year old girl who doesn't laugh at all through the film, but every time she thinks something's funny, she goes, "That's funny." I was like, "That's amazing."
Was her dad Mike Schur?
I was just like, "This kid's incredible."
I did not have Mike Schur catching a stray on this podcast. That was amazing.
No, we love him. We respect him. We were
just like, wait, what the fuck, man? I'm just like, I'm not even there.
Yeah, what's he like? What did I do?
We don't hide kisses penis for a chance.
That was amazing.
I think that we got a young Adam Goldberg at one point.
Yeah, that was kind of cool.
That was fun.
It's fine. So we mentioned this earlier, but it's worth unpacking just very quickly. I don't want to even call it a love triangle because it's not really a love triangle, but basically Buddy and Stan both want Julie Warner. And as you beautifully illustrated earlier, Stan has to like serve her up to him on a platter, essentially. It's all kind of weird and fucked up. And I would say, in fact, that like, there's no chemistry between Billy Crystal and Julie Warner. Like, there's none.
Well, she has about 5 lines the entire movie.
Most of it's just laughing at his jokes.
And laughing at his jokes. Also, I just want to say, this is something that I wrote down. When you are performing stand-up, you absolutely cannot pick out a woman in the crowd. Like,
oh yeah, no,
it's 50 feet away, you can't see the crowd.
Of course not.
At all. It's fucking nuts, and he does it at like 5 shows. When his brother walks in at the end with his wife the first time, the guy can't. It just doesn't happen.
It's like anyone on stage. It's like when you're at a concert, they like this lead singer will be like, "Can you turn the lights down so I can see people?"
Yes, like, of course.
It's a known thing.
Trump's always like, is that person in the crowd?
Yeah, you can't see shit. Yeah. So at this point in the film, we have Helen Hunt who shows up. And Helen Hunt is a young agent at some agency because Jerry Orbach has an interest, whatever it is. And Jerry
Orbach, I'm very into fake agency names in movies.
What is it? Which one is this?
Signed.
ITI.
Sure.
ITI. Which
I don't know who they're riffing
talent.
On.
Something anyway.
Italy.
So he goes to meet Jerry Orbach because they go way back, and Jerry Orbach's like pretending to laugh at his jokes, and then Jerry basically punts him onto Helen Hunt because he understandably is like, this guy's not going to get any work, so what the fuck should I do this? So Helen Hunt shows up at first, and she doesn't know any of his shit, and he just absolutely humiliates her and says all sorts of terrible stuff to her. And for reasons that escape me, she subjects herself to it a second time and shows up at his door, this time having done the research of understanding his world.
Yes, she read the great encyclopedia of 1930s comedy and came back with 5 facts.
Like, but if you can't work with me because I don't know who Shecky Green is, that's fine. We just work together. It's totally fine.
But what's amazing about this is that, first of all, I like Helen Hunt as an actor. I think she's a very good actor, and I think she, you know, brings some legitimacy to this role. And I think that in general, I think she's, you know, she seems like a big-hearted performer, right? Like, I feel like you can sort of feel her, there's a real genuine watchability to her. And I think that casting her makes sense. That being said, no agent that I've ever met would subject themselves to what she subjects herself to on numerous occasions, relentlessly, in fact.
Like, and literally the returns she's getting are 10% of a warm-up comic. Like,
is that even, like, I don't even know what that is, but it's not a lot, I'm assuming.
It's like, I mean, it's like you get SAG's day rate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I just, it is a weird...
I mean, I've done it, and it's so easy to not do what Billy Crystal did in this. And I know,
think if, like, you're good at it, I think you can get like 10 grand an episode if you're good at it.
I'm not good at it.
If you're Mark Sweet, if you're the Marks, the Mark Sweets of the world.
So, okay. Yeah. So let's just say that if you, that's not nothing, right? If you're doing warm up for a talk show or for a multicam, that could be good money if you're doing.
You're banking on there being many, many episodes, and therefore,
All this being said, she sort of subjects herself to this, and it's hard to understand why, outside of the fact that maybe she just feels bad for this old guy that, you know, got a, you know, a, well, no, he didn't get a shitty break. He was terrible. So, like, that's just how it goes. But she goes through all of this. And, like, as I mentioned earlier, there was a movie for me in the notion of these two characters, right? This young agent, this older comic, and, like, there's something there.
There feels like a scent of a woman.
Sure.
Well, I'm just saying.
Age well, but yeah.
Because the idea of you being. Sorry, it was maybe the. But I'm just saying, older, younger, you know, yes, it can work.
Yeah. No, for sure.
And I'm saying also, like, Sean and I are about the points in our careers where we can't get anything either, and we're going to have to beg for agents. So, like, this is like a very. I'm just saying the slice that you're taking out of the movie is like a very relatable, understandable. This guy's been put out to pasture, but, like, let's bring him back. Like, you know, it happens a lot.
For sure. And that's why I'm sort of like, there's a version of a movie where it's just, I'm pulling a name out of thin air, but, you know, a Judd Hirsch-esque older gentleman, older actor who, like, everybody loved, and then for whatever reason just outmoded, and an agent wants to give him one last kick at the can and get him a gig in a movie, whatever it is, right? Like, there's something there. And I think that, unfortunately, because the buddy character is just so fucking awful and repellent, it's just really hard for Helen Hunt. And I just watch her just being like, you're trying. Lord knows why you're trying. And I feel for you. But, like, what are you doing?
Well, again, it's like just a copy of a copy. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen The Sunshine Boys.
Yeah, the Burns, right? George Burns?
Yeah, George Burns and Walter Matthau from the 70s, Neil Simon play. But it's literally about exactly this. And it has, like, a nephew who's an agent who really wants his uncle to perform on CBS and, like, the history of comedy, like, variety show. And, like, it's honestly, they earn everything in that movie. It's so good. And yeah, like, it but also they're willing to look like fucking assholes because they were assholes to each other. And, like, yeah, it just goes back to that always. Like, Billy Crystal does not view this character as, like, three-dimensional at all. He views him as, like, a joke vessel that he can make all the jokes he's ever wanted to make, you know, just a constant steady stream of zeros for 2 hours and 4 minutes.
Well, I do think at this point their mom dies and he goes to her funeral and he sort of turns her funeral into a stand-up routine, which again, in theory, I don't have issues with. In theory, Buddy, his only, it's so hacky, but, like, his only way of communicating is through jokes, right? And his only way of showing his love for his mother was through these jokes.
But that's already deeper than the movie gets.
100%. I'm just saying that's what they clearly are going for.
Yeah.
Because his mom disappears for a full hour. Like,
oh, yeah.
And then she is just used to die to get to this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yep. Oh, the other comparison, which is obvious.
Yes.
It's Hacks. Like, this could have been Hacks.
Yes.
Like, there's that take of it with an agent or whatever. But Phil, when you're talking about the agent character, you're not talking about just, like, a stupid woman agent. You're talking about, like, it's an assistant who just got promoted, who's been given the difficult client because she lives in a shitty apartment with her boyfriend and her roommate who's fucking random guys all night, and you just want her to fucking win and be able to move. Like, and there's no character has any of that juice.
I know. Totally agree with you.
As soon as she shows up, there's so much fucking disdain for her, mostly because she's a woman.
I mean, 100%. All of
that is right? That is exactly what Buddy is mad about, is that he's like, I'm supposed to respect a woman?
A woman? This is comedy.
Yeah.
What do you know about comedy, lady?
I mean, that's the other thing. If he was like, I know this woman, she fucked up my job on the whatever contract, blah, 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 you'd be like, all right. But it's like, you're a woman, and this is comedy, and get out of here.
Yeah, you don't know who Ernie Kovacs is? Get out of the Friars Club! Because I do even think she goes, what is this place?
Yeah.
She theoretically had to get in a cab and say, take me to the Friars Club.
The idea that an agent wouldn't know what the Friars Club is anyway.
I mean, bonkers. I absolutely agree with you 100%. And I think that the casting of Helen Hunt is ultimately giving you more than the character deserves, because there's no depth to the character, but they cast it well. So there's an element of humanity that's being emanated from this character, even though like her dialogue is not.
And I think you think this is going to be a strong character.
Absolutely.
Like Helen Hunt's not just going to get dumped on the whole. Oh, she is actually. Okay.
It's the weird part too. I mean, this is not Helen Hunt at Helen Hunt's peak, for what it's worth. This is
first 100%. But still, but she does have a gravitas to her.
She shows up like mid movie. And because the fucking narrative is so insane and makes no sense, we meet her and then the Crockett shit happens. And like, there's all this like weird jumping through time. And again, we know he fucked up. Like, we know that something went awry. It's so much of this is so telegraphed that as an audience member, you're so bored because you know every move as before it happens.
You know every move, and then you're actually just disappointed in how
yes,
or like how mundane his like cancellation is. It's just like he didn't really do anything insane. It's not like, you know, like I just wanted there to be more teeth throughout the entire thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because also it's so clear to me that like Billy Crystal is coming into this world or putting this movie into the world from a very negative space. It's like, we're forgetting these guys. I'm terrified that one day people are going to forget me. I relate to this guy in some way. And there's none of that. He's just so afraid of talking about that actual feeling of being forgotten, which is all this movie's about, to the point where they completely ignore what he did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, like the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, outside of the joke about him being my hippie phase and then doing a Saturday Night Fever parody, I'm like, I think that could have been funny to see.
Yeah.
It would have been way funnier to see than be told, I think.
Yeah.
This is the thing. This movie is surprisingly like linear and boring, and also has the potential to
Jumps around in time. It's linear with jumping around in time,
so it's
almost weird, impossible.
It's absurd to watch it, and you're just sort of like, there are some meaty scenes in this movie. Specifically, there's one in the alley between Buddy and Stan, where basically they sort of hash it all out, right? And it's like, it's a relatively good scene, I guess, even though Stan gets no words in and it's just fucking Buddy just barfing up all this shit. But I'm really struck with what you were saying earlier, Sean, about like, he can't be wrong. He can never be the quote unquote the bad guy, which is so antithetical if you want this guy to be an asshole. Like, if you want him to be an asshole, if you want him to be like, and forgive the maybe the obvious comparison, but if you look at Adam Sandler in Funny People, right? Like, he is a dick. He's an asshole. Kind of knows he's an asshole. And like, even in the end, he kind of sort of softens a little bit, but like in the end, he's still kind of a prick. And you just kind of know that. And that's just, the movie has the confidence to be able to kind of own that. This movie wants you not to like him, to have some confidence, but then also to be like, but it's Billy and you love Billy and everything's fine. It's just, it's too kind of at odds
with it's them. Not fine.
It's not fine. We got to talk about this audition scene because it's fucking crazy. So what happens is, for our listeners, Buddy meets Ron Silver as some sort of Spielbergian, I don't know, hot director or whatever the fuck, and who wants to make a movie and has written this character, this grandfather character, whose name is Buddy, because he was such an uber fan of Buddy's early work, of which it seems there was not much, but sure.
He saw him live once at 8, and it just, like, you know... Yeah,
blew his little mind.
He imprinted, like, Taylor Lautner on Robert Pattinson and Kirsten Stewart's baby.
Exactly, yeah. So he's making this movie, and it looks like he's going to get this role. And for the first time, Buddy's, like, actually wants a fucking role, right? Like, he actually wants this gig. He can see the potential in it.
Blah, blah, blah. He reads the script. He memorizes the lines, which is not like him.
It's not like him. He gets his. He coerces his brother into helping him with the fucking script to learn
his
all the
brother
lines.
Misses his grandchild's birthday
yes.
to help a man who basically told him to drop dead and die. Go to Florida. You're dead to me.
Correct.
And he's like, no, for this role as grandfather, Buddy, the hottest director in the world, movie.
See, he gets it. So all this happens, all in preparation for an audition. He sits down, and the first thing the director says is, yeah, don't have the role. Someone else got the role, but we'd love you to audition for this other smaller part.
Hold on, Phil.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
We approached Walter Matthau a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, this is, sorry, you're right.
He wasn't interested. Yeah, but then he called, and he's interested, so he's got the part.
Yeah.
And then the casting agent, there was a thing with Helen Hunt on, like, was there a phone call? It was very
off camera.
Yeah, it was like this is how this works in Hollywood, which is hilarious.
It's literally from out of frame, you hear her say, why didn't you tell me? And he's like, we tried to call you. Shut the fuck up, Helen Hunt. You're just a woman. What do you know? It's essentially what this is.
It was disgusting that she would try to participate in comedy.
Even try to defend her client. Now, for listeners that are not, you know, in Hollywood or maybe don't know about the machinations of Hollywood, there is no fucking world where a director who are cowards would ever put themselves in a position to the person's face say, you didn't get the role. It would be done entirely through phone calls, through representation.
You just let them read. Just let them read. Give us your best shot.
Exactly.
Like, who cares?
Yeah. Exactly. It is so crazy to me. It would be the equivalent of, you know, for a TV writer to get a staffing meeting with a showrunner and the showrunner to, for reasons only to hurt themselves, to create a awkward situation and say, no, you didn't get the job.
Yeah. And possibly get this job. Yeah. Before I ask you what your story is, I just want to let you know the end of my story is you're not hired.
It's so crazy to watch. Now, listen, I understand that for dramatic purposes, having Buddy in that scene have this all happen to him is more quote unquote, you know, interactive, I guess. But like, these are Hollywood people. Like, fuck off with this nonsense. No one's buying this.
I have to tell this story, which I should tell off podcast, but I'll just tell it now. I won't name any names.
Okay.
But I did have a meeting on a show. They need a showrunner. Come meet on this show. The day before the meeting, I get an email that says they decided to hire an all Asian staff, so you can't get the job, but we still want to meet with you tomorrow.
Did you go?
Yeah, it's had like a stupid general Zoom. I was like, well, fucking wild for you to say to me.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not legal. But anyway, let's go forward.
This just speaks to this idea that, like, it would be entirely through email or phone call. I mean, 1982, it wouldn't be emails, but still be a phone call.
Definitely a phone call.
Yeah.
That's why it's. But they would just be like, "Hey, man, read," and then they'd be like, oh, "I mean, what are we talking about?
I want to see my hero's face as I break his heart."
Then also the other point that we haven't mentioned is, They do like a little confab. They go off after he's offered an opportunity to audition for the smaller role.
Yeah.
So Buddy and Stan and Helen Hunt's character, Annie, I think, or whatever, he's like, so what should I do? Should I audition for this other role? And they're like, it's still a big movie. Like, you should still do whatever. And then he auditions with the grandfather fucking lines. So he auditions for the role he didn't get. Not for the role that he's auditioning for, which makes no sense. And then the thing that I kind of hate the most out of this, and this again speaks to what you were saying, Sean, about Billy refusing to let the character ever be wrong or weak. He's the one that basically says, go fuck yourself. He's the one that says, I'm better than all of you. And I refuse to, like, it's just like, it fucking sucks, man.
It's like, I don't even want the role. It's like, well,
it's like, have some humility.
Okay. Yeah. You're like having a fucking meltdown. And like, in every scene, he's having a meltdown about how nobody cares about how he's
See
done.
What I did there? No one cares about me.
The whole thing is just like an old man crying like wolf with suicide. And I'm just like, just do it, buddy. Like, it's all we want. I was begging you to do it 30 minutes into this movie.
It is really frustrating that we have these scenes back to back. We have this audition scene followed by the daughter scene, right? So it's like, oh, sorry, forgive me. There's three scenes. Audition scene, Stan scene in the alleyway where he just fucking screams at him for 5 minutes about how, you know, he was a pussy and he didn't fucking try hard and that's why he didn't get the girl and that's why his life sucks or whatever. Just terrible
also,
shit.
To say that, and then Stan is always talking about his grandchildren. So obviously he got married, had kids, his wife died, and he's still like, oh, you want to eat out my wife, you loser.
I mean, he's not wrong. They have this weird scene in the kitchen that has like this weird like energy that I didn't like.
Yes. Well, because everyone should have to want what Billy has.
Yeah.
Billy fucking rocks. So like you should lust after his wife because she doesn't talk and she laughs at your jokes.
It's so true though. Like the whole movie is about like, don't you want to be Buddy Young? It's like, yeah. No.
No.
I don't want anything to do with this guy.
Truly what this movie should have done in the Jerry Lewis scene is have Buddy go up to Jerry Lewis. But no, Billy is such a fucking egomaniac. Jerry Lewis comes over and talks to him. Sure, he's insulting him, but it's still like, no, you approach me.
This movie, I mean, truthfully really does make me dislike Billy Crystal. So, Sean, you have succeeded in that regard. It can't hurt when Harry Met Sally because that's unhurtable or unkillable, but I still, you know. Yeah.
But it's like, here's all this money, go make the thing that you dream about making, and you're like, this is it? Fuck off.
It's crazy. So then we get a scene with this hacky double take bullshit, and it's brutal. And then we see Buddy playing in these retirement homes. And in Florida, I'm assuming, and Stan shows up with a painting of them as kids, just super fucking cheesy.
Just being such a fucking, I can't use any of these words that are in my head right now.
Okay.
They don't get canceled. But just being such a fucking twerp about the whole thing. I mean,
yes, just
like, what a fucking loss. He's just an asshole. I mean,
it's hard to sort of, and I know that like, movies are still littered with these roles of wives that are just kind of there as emotional wallpaper. And it fucking sucks that they still tend to be in movies. But like, this is such a prime example of this where like when he meets Elaine, how old are we supposed to be like thinking she is and he is?
Yeah. She's with her parents, but yeah. Like,
yeah, that was weird too. When he was like, at that moment when he's like, go get this girl, I was like, oh, this movie's about to get interesting. This is like, he's going to bang a 15-year-old or something. Like, what is this?
That's the thing. Yeah. She's like one step from having pigtails. Like, I feel like they're just like kind of giving this kind of youthful vibe, whereas Billy is like fucking Billy Crystal. He looks like he's 50.
Well, also, you know, it's not even woman as wallpaper. It's woman as trophy.
Well, that
and like, and the assumption that David Paymer wanted her in that one small moment, and that for the rest of his life, he has the exact same passion about her as fucking Looney Tunes.
Looney Tunes. Again, wife and children, and like just being like, you know, my sister-in-law, that's the one.
And like, he has to be with her every fucking holiday. Holidays plus Jewish holidays. All the holidays.
All the holidays.
It's like this guy was probably like, ah, man, I fucking dodged a bullet there. I don't need that one. Like, I mean,
Dodging bullets, Kira Sedgwick was supposed to play this role and got pregnant. Oh. So she could not
do it. Oh, wow. That is a... But truly, like, to me, the wife, you want a scene with the wife and the daughter to kind of, like, I think that would have helped bridge that storyline, like, even somewhere in the middle, like, having the wife talk about how, like, how complicated Buddy is or something.
Your dad actually loves you.
Yes.
He can't say it. He can't do it.
Here's the thing, Sean, and you said this earlier, but, like, and you did too, Hunter, of like how many bits there are. This movie is 2 hours long. That's a lot of real estate, which means you can service a lot more characters if you cut some of the fucking bits, man.
Like, and the same bits you've seen.
And yes. Right. Like, if you trim some of that stuff down, you can give Paymer more stuff so you can at least get a sense of him. You give Helen Hunt more stuff. You can give the wife more stuff. But they're all pushed aside for this fucking douchebag.
It's like,
a vanity project. It is 100% a vanity project.
100%. And it's just like the economy of storytelling is so fucked in this, because you just need him at a retirement home. You just need him to say one joke that you've already heard. And you're like, oh, he's doing the set. He's doing the same set that he did. And it tells that story.
Totally.
But instead, it's like, no, he's going to do all of them again. Like,
these jokes are too good. Time. Yeah.
You're like, no, I don't fucking, what?
But it's also, it's kind of neither fish nor fowl in how much present day and how much flashbacks we have. It's almost 50-50, or it's at least like 60-40.
Yeah, I think it's very close. Like,
you gotta pick a fucking lane. Is this a movie about a guy in present day dealing with shit? And if it is, then you get a handful of flashbacks at best. But they don't want that. They want that fucking period stuff. So you're just like,
The period stuff, like, he's always crushing. You never see him fail outside of the first joke he tells. And then he instantly gets them back, which also does not happen. If you eat it on the first joke, you're not winning them back just by going like, that guy's fat.
Yeah. It honestly feels like he came out of the womb going like, huh? Like, it just feels like he's just like doing bits from the day.
Very much so.
It is frustrating.
Well, as somebody who has seen 700 Sundays, his one-man show, around
Why?
Six times, I had, like, I was trying, I kept rewatching because I was just trying to figure out why Billy Crystal is the way he is. And this is, like, the closest we'll ever come to understanding. And basically all those scenes of him performing in, like, his living room is straight out of his real life. That's what he would do. And basically, his comedian origin story is everyone he's ever met until he did comedy told him he should do comedy. They all said he was the funniest person in the entire world. And 700 Sundays is packaged as a son's love letter to his father. It is not that. It is everyone in his neighborhood telling him he's the funniest person on earth. And he does it for an hour and a half. He's a psycho.
That sounds crazy. That sounds like actually sociopathic.
I was texting jokes to you guys last night, and I had typed one out, and I was like, I'm saving it for the podcast because I'm going to burn out all my material.
All your good shit?
Yeah, and I was going to send you guys, this movie is 700 Sundays long.
Yeah, I mean, this. So it needs to be said just very briefly as we wrap this up. There was a musical made of this, speaking of the stage.
Jesus Christ. Come on.
I'm serious. There was a musical that was on Broadway. It ran from, it premiered on July 17th.
Did it close July 18th?
And it closed on September 4th. 28 previews and 116 performances. It's got a lot of songs. David Paymer also played Stan again. Billy Crystal played Mr. Saturday Night again.
Are they in young makeup now?
I couldn't tell you.
For the flashbacks?
It was not. So listen to this. It opens on April 27th, 2012. The people that were at opening night, Steve Martin, Martin Short, Tina Fey, Jimmy Fallon, Bryan Cranston, like just a who's who of people that
people
were forced
have
to
not
see through
the movie.
Fucking thing. No. They've never seen the movie. Of course not. It got I mean, truly, it was nominated for Best Musical, Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score. Didn't win anything. He won.
Yeah, there's only like five new ones a year, so this they, is like, they nominate everything.
This is also like New York City. This is like he's their fucking guy. Like, yeah.
Variety called it the funniest show on Broadway in years, if not the most likable.
Is that the bar though? I mean, compared to something else.
The thing is, and I think we know that
this is 2022.
Correct.
So are they counting like since like Book of Mormon?
Listen, man, probably. I don't know. The other thing too is Broadway is obviously just as susceptible to IP disease as TV and movies are. 100%, so I'm sure they were just like, here's a fucking thing. We could do this. There's people that'll pay us to turn it into a musical. Are you interested?
I don't even think it's that. Phil, I'm telling you, you put Billy Crystal on the marquee on Broadway, you can do over 100 shows. Like, it just doesn't even matter.
Yeah, that happened. So let's wrap this up.
I had another idea for a good movie.
Okay.
He gets the cruise and they go on the cruise together.
Yes.
And all this happens on the cruise.
Better movie.
Also, they get on the cruise. They get on the cruise and they're like, oh, we canceled you. We have the younger comedian here.
Also,
then they have to be there.
Jesus, dude. That's,
and they're
that's
there a sitting in the failure. Before. Yes. Yeah.
And they have to be there, and it's like, oh, you should be doing stand-up here. And he's like, eh, I was supposed to. Like, then you got some juice.
That's great. And then he falls off the boat at the end.
Yeah, I know. David Paymer fucking kills him. Dumps him
off the fucking boat.
In the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah. And he sacrifices himself to save Billy Crystal's wife. Oh,
God. But no, truly, you have pitched an infinitely better movie, a tighter movie, a movie that makes sense.
Yeah.
A movie that has, like, propulsion and drive. So I came into this podcast today at a pretty generous 40. I'm down to a 20 now. Sean, you've successfully definitely brought Billy Crystal down in my esteem.
Oh, this is a Billy Crystal rating.
No, this is the movie, but part of this is just, I don't think, despite the fact that I didn't like Buddy's character and that I didn't like this movie, I don't think that I tapped into just how sort of toxic the vanity of Billy Crystal was to this movie, like how cancerous that is. And when you dive into that, you see how, like, there's no bottom to where this movie is.
Yeah.
But Hunter, where are you at? What's your rating?
You know, I think, like, I really appreciate Sean's ability to kind of root out all that Billy Crystal stuff, because I don't know that I care enough to, like, put that much thought in. Like, I like, but not, I mean, I feel the same way, because I almost just punted and said 50.
Yeah.
Because I think, I know I made the joke earlier, but I do think there's a small subset of people in America that this would be like a down the middle fastball, like
100%.
Fucking.
Especially in 92.
Yeah, give me this Borscht Belt super easy jokes that you've heard a million times, but you have like a, for people who have nostalgia, people like Billy Crystal who have nostalgia for this thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you view it through the lens of this is Billy Crystal and this is what he's doing, it's like a fucking zero. It's like a propaganda film. It's like, this has no value.
I mean, that's the thing, because like I think very similar to what you're saying, Hunter. Like, I watched it and I was like, this isn't good. I'm not enjoying myself. I can't wait for this to be over. But Sean really just kind of like tore open the guts of this thing and was like, do you see what's here?
He said he was going to do it.
Yeah.
Wait a second. Can I read the text?
Yeah, you can read the text.
I mean, this is like a literal text.
It's very successfully did what he set out to do.
Now I can't find it. Where is this?
I'll pull it up. It was.
Anyway, it's.
Hold on. No, I mean,
I can say with absolute certainty that after this podcast is out, I will not be working with Billy Crystal in my life.
That's exactly right. And you fucking delivered. And
you delivered.
You delivered eloquently to the point, if Billy Crystal listened to this, he might do some reflection. Because I don't think you're
malicious. And he won't. Well, can I just, I want to, so can I read the text that you sent, Sean, about,
sure.
about what your wife said?
Oh, yeah.
Your wife said, "No one sets me off like Billy Crystal. Buddy Young Jr. voice, he's like milk to my bowel."
Which is exactly what he would say.
Oh, my God.
Within the voice of the thing you're critiquing.
Yeah, it's tremendous.
It was good.
Where did you start and where are you at now?
Okay, so movies about like classic show business, very specifically about like this era of comedy, I have like such a soft spot for. I truly love it. Like, I'm obsessed with
the lead.
I'm obsessed with whole comedy. Like, I love it. Like, to the point where I'm in a room right now, and our showrunner begged me and another writer to stop talking about the Bowery Boys, who are like an older version of our gang. And this is just like, I truly love the foundation of stand-up comedy and all that. So I was like, I'm going into this knowing that I don't love Billy Crystal, but I do believe that like, I had a 50% chance of liking this movie, just based on subject matter. It is a complete zero. I fucking hated it. Like, to the point where I'm on several text chains that I just started ranting about this. And people are like, "What? I don't care. I didn't even know that was a movie. I hate it. I hate Billy Crystal even more now. Two thumbs down.
This for me.
Letterboxd review that just says, "Fuck you, dude."
This movie feels like the original Phone Checker. I mean, there's a certain point in the movie where you're like, "Don't care, man." Like, don't.
Like, it's tremendous.
There's other shit going on in the world, and I need to look at my phone right now and try to.
It is amazing. Also, when I rated it on Letterboxd, I had a friend text me and say, "Why do I have two people in my feed that have watched Sarin?" Like, listen, we're doing an episode. It's going to be something. I mean, truthfully, this is just one of those films that feels really kind of like prime 1992, right? Like, this could never exist at another time. I mean, obviously the converse, or you know what it is now, is Maisel, but that's what I would argue is a very different animal. Even if
I don't even think that could have been a movie. Yeah. That would never be a movie. It's like, who's going to watch it?
But it's crazy to watch this film and just be like, that this guy could get basically the equivalent of like $80 or $90 million to make this vanity project is pretty shocking. So next week, I'm curious if you guys have a take on this. We're doing Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth.
Oh, interesting.
Are you guys Hellraiser fans? Have you seen any of the Hellraisers?
I think I've seen the first one. And Hellraiser, I'm just going to call the dude Hellraiser.
Well, the dude's name is Pinhead. I mean,
Pinhead.
Be respectful.
Incredible design and incredibly terrifying.
Yep,
and the whole idea of the box.
Yep.
Amazing. Don't really know anything past any of that.
I am obsessed with one guy in Hellraiser 2.
Okay.
And that is it. Like, I think I've only seen Hellraiser and Hellraiser 2, but Hellraiser 2 has this guy who kind of looks like a big duck, and I like him.
He sounds great. I'll be honest with you.
That sounds sort of familiar, though.
I don't know much about Hellraiser. I was not really a horror kid, so like I hadn't seen a lot of them. We had Jennifer Hutcheson came on. She's a writer on Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad and Mad Men. And anyway, she's great. The movies, it's interesting. It's got some hot takes on religion and Vietnam. It's like there's a whole Vietnam portion of this movie where we learn that like Pinhead was involved and sort of involved in Vietnam.
Oh, he served? Thank you for your service, Pinhead.
Thank you for your service, Pinhead.
Yeah, it's like, come on, guys. Get off his back. The Viet Cong, like, very, like, just very mapped out how they were going to torture
individual
him.
Pins. Yeah, it was a whole thing.
Don't just fucking stick pins in his head. Come on! Like, this is...
But guys, I can't thank you enough for coming on, talking about this movie, watching this movie.
My question is, like, after the Letterboxd thing to me is so funny.
Yeah.
Do you think his IMDb star meter went up? Because the three of us watch this?
Yeah.
Like skyrocketing now?
Billy, so he, I actually did look up Billy Crystal's directing because he's directed three things. And have you, did you guys remember this movie Here Today that came out in 2021?
With Tiffany Haddish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that?
Oh, right. Yeah.
I think he plays an elderly comic and she, and
really?
Yeah. She's somebody who is either a comedian herself or like somebody who's like, escorting a successful him around comedy the city.
Screenwriter. God, I thought I actually wish it was the continuing adventures of Buddy. Like it would have been great if it was Buddy Young.
He'd be like, I got this character.
It's I
like,
got oh, this character.
Please, no.
Yeah, he wrote it. Billy Crystal wrote it, directed it. Whew, this is just rough. Tiffany Haddish produced it. Anyway, it was a thing. It made less than $3 million, but it was a movie. It came out. But guys, this was always, as always, a pleasure. I hope that you'll both come back.
I love it. I'll do any movie, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, actually... I'll tell you something when we're done, but because I would love you guys to obviously come back, but just in terms of like future episodes that I would like you guys to come on for. But is there anything you guys want to plug?
No, the thing I'm working on is animated.
The episode should just stop.
Yeah, just stop. Enough. I'm literally working on an animated show for the first time in my career. It will air in 2025, which I'm be honest with you. I don't know if I'm going to be here. I mean, like, I don't know if any of us are going to be here. It's the fucking, like, to me, 2025 feels like 2075. I mean, it feels no different. It feels so far away.
It's so far into the future. It sounds made up. It sounds Jetson-y.
It's next year, guys.
Yeah. But it's not right.
But I started working on this last year.
Yeah.
Listen, it is tough. It's not easy right now in this town. So I feel you. But Sean, you're working on something right now?
Something animated that will be premiering in 2025. It hasn't been announced.
Mine hasn't been announced either, actually. I don't even know if I can plug it. I don't think I can plug it.
I can just say guys. 2025 coming to blank flicks. Watch it.
I
any original.
I'm going to be on one of the streamers with a plus at the end.
Ooh,
so there's more exciting. Than one, which is kind of crazy.
There's two Flixes at the end. There's Netflix or Pure Flix. You decide which.
Oh man, if you're on Pure Flix,
all I know is that our listeners are going to get to watch things that you guys wrote next year, and that's exciting.
That's fun. I mean, they can watch things that we wrote this year, too.
This is true.
Yeah.
They just won't be new. Yeah.
And you won't see any money for it.
That's right.
Listen, this was a blast, as always. And I thank you both so much for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Phil.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.